Norton thought. What could Rodrigo add to it? Our faith has told us to expect such a visitation, though we do not know exactly what form it will take. The Bible gives hints. If this is not the second coming, it may be the second judgment. The story of Noah describes the first. I believe that Rama is a cosmic ark, sent here to save those who are worthy of salvation. There was silence for quite a while in the cabin. It was not that Norton was at a loss for words. Rather, he could think of too many questions, but was not sure which ones it would be tactful to ask. Finally, he remarked, in as mild and non-committal a voice as he could manage, "That's a very interesting concept, and though I don't go along with your faith, it's a tantalizingly plausible one." He was not being hypocritical or flattering. Stripped of its religious overtones, Rodrigo's theory was at least as convincing as half a dozen others he had heard. Suppose some catastrophe was about to befall the human race, and a benevolent higher intelligence knew all about it. That would explain everything very neatly. However, there were still a few problems. A couple of questions, Boris. Rama will be at perihelion in 3 weeks. Then it will round the sun and leave the solar system just as fast as it came in. There's not much time for a day of judgment, or for shipping across those who are, selected. However, that's going to be done.
Very true. So when it reaches perihelion, Rama will have to decelerate and go into a parking orbit, probably one with aphelion at Earth's orbit. There it might make another velocity change and rendezvous with Earth.
This was disturbingly persuasive. If Rama wished to remain in the solar system, it was going the right way about it. The most efficient way to slow down was to get as close to the sun as possible and carry out the braking maneuver there. If there was any truth in Rodrigo's theory, or some variant of it, it would soon be put to the test.
One other point, Boris. What's controlling Rama now?
There is no doctrine to advise on that. It could be a pure robot, or it could be a spirit. That would explain why there are no signs of biological life forms.
The haunted asteroid. Why had that phrase popped up from the depths of memory? Then he recalled a silly story he had read years ago, but thought it best not to ask Rodrigo if he had ever seen it. He doubted if the other's tastes ran to that sort of reading.
"I'll tell you what we'll do, Boris," he said, abruptly making up his mind. He wanted to terminate this interview before it got too difficult, and thought he had found a good compromise. "Can you sum up your ideas in less than, 1,000 bits?
"Yes, I think so."
"Well, if you can make it sound like a straightforward scientific theory, I'll send it, top priority, to the Rama Committee. Then a copy can go to your church at the same time, and everyone will be happy."
"Thank you, Commander. I really appreciate it."
"Oh, I'm not doing this to save my conscience. I'd just like to see what the committee makes of it. Even if I don't agree with you all along the line, you may have hit on something important."
"Well, we'll know at perihelion, won't we?"
"Yes, we'll know at perihelion."
When Rodrigo had left, Norton called the bridge and gave the necessary authorization. He thought he had solved the problem rather neatly. Besides, just suppose that Rodrigo was right. He might have increased his chances of being among the saved.
After the storm.
as they drifted along the now familiar corridor of the Alpha Airlock Complex, Norton wondered if they had let impatience overcome caution. They had waited aboard Endeavor for 48 hours, two precious days, ready for instant departure if events should justify it. But nothing had happened. The instruments left in Rama had detected no unusual activity. Frustratingly, the television camera on the hub had been blinded by a fog that had reduced visibility to a few meters and had only now started to retreat. When they operated the final airlock door and floated out into the cat's cradle of guide ropes around the hub, Norton was struck first by the change in the light. It was no longer harshly blue, but was much more mellow and gentle, reminding him of a bright, hazy day on Earth. He looked outward along the axis of the world and could see nothing except a glowing, featureless tunnel of white, reaching all the way to those strange mountains at the South Pole. The interior of Rama was completely blanketed by clouds, and nowhere was a break visible in the overcast. The top of the layer was quite sharply defined. It formed a smaller cylinder inside the larger one of this spinning world, leaving a central core, 5 or 6 kilometers wide, quite clear, except for a few stray wisps of cirrus. The immense tube of cloud was lit from within by the 6 artificial suns of Rama. The locations of the 3 on this northern continent were clearly defined by diffuse strips of light, but those on the far side of the cylindrical sea merged together into a continuous, glowing band. "What is happening down beneath those clouds?" Norton asked himself. But at least the storm, which had centrifuged them into such perfect symmetry about the axis of Rama, had now died away. Unless there were some other surprises, it would be safe to descend. It seemed appropriate, on this return visit, to use the team that had made the first deep penetration into Rama. Sergeant Myron, like every other member of Endeavor's crew, now fully met Surgeon Commander Ernst's physical requirements. He even maintained, with convincing sincerity, that he was never going to wear his old uniforms again. As Norton watched Mercer, Calvert, and Myron swimming quickly and confidently down the ladder, he reminded himself how much had changed. That first time, they had descended in cold and darkness. Now, they were going toward light and warmth. And on all earlier visits, they had been certain that Rama was dead. That might yet be true, in a biological sense. But something was stirring, and Boris Rodrigo's word would do as well as any other. The spirit of Rama was awake. When they had reached the platform at the foot of the ladder and were preparing to start down the stairway, Mercer carried out his usual routine test of the atmosphere. There were some things that he never took for granted, even when the people around him were breathing perfectly comfortably, without aids. He had been known to stop for an air check before opening his helmet. When asked to justify such excessive caution, he had answered,
"Because human senses aren't good enough, that's why. You may think you're fine, but you could fall flat on your face with the next deep breath."
He looked at his meter and said,
"Damn."
"What's the trouble?" asked Calvert.
"It's broken. Reading too high. Odd. I've never known that to happen before. I'll check it on my breathing circuit."
He plugged the compact little analyzer into the test point of his oxygen supply, then stood in thoughtful silence for a while. His companions looked at him with anxious concern. Anything that upset Mercer was to be taken seriously indeed. He unplugged the meter, used it to sample the Rama atmosphere again, then called hub control.
"Skipper,
Will you take an O2 reading?
There was a much longer pause than the request justified. Then Norton radioed back, I think there's something wrong with my meter.
A slow smile spread across Mercer's face. It's up 50%, isn't it?
Yes. What does that mean?
It means that we can all take off our masks. Isn't that convenient?
I'm not sure, replied Norton, echoing the sarcasm in Mercer's voice. It seems too good to be true. There was no need to say any more. Like all spacemen, Norton had a profound suspicion of things that were too good to be true. Mercer cracked his mask open a trifle and took a cautious sniff. For the first time at this altitude, the air was perfectly breathable. The musty, dead smell had gone. So had the excessive dryness, which in the past had caused several respiratory complaints. Humidity was now an astonishing 80%. Doubtless the thawing of the sea was responsible for this. There was a muggy feeling in the air, though not an unpleasant one. It was like a summer evening, Mercer thought, on some tropical coast. The climate inside Rama had improved dramatically during the last few days. And why? The increased humidity was no problem. The startling rise in oxygen was much more difficult to explain. As he recommenced the descent, Mercer began a whole series of mental calculations. He had not arrived at any satisfactory result by the time they entered the cloud layer. It was a dramatic experience, for the transition was abrupt. At one moment, they were sliding downward in clear air, gripping the smooth metal of the handrail so that they would not gain speed too swiftly in this quarter of a gravity region. Then, suddenly, they shot into a blinding white fog, and visibility dropped to a few meters. Mercer put on the brakes so quickly that Calvert almost bumped into him, and Myron did bump into Calvert, nearly knocking him off the rail.
Take it easy, said Mercer. Spread out so we can just see each other, and don't let yourself build up speed, in case I have to stop suddenly.
In eerie silence, they continued to glide downward through the fog. Calvert could just see Mercer as a vague shadow 10 meters ahead, and when he looked back, Myron was at the same distance behind him. In some ways, this was even spookier than descending in the complete darkness of the Raman night. Then, at least, the searchlight beams had shown them what lay ahead. But this was like diving in poor visibility in the open sea. It was impossible to tell how far they had traveled, but Calvert guessed they had almost reached the fourth level when Mercer suddenly braked again. After they had bunched together, he whispered,
Listen, don't you hear something?
Yes, said Myron after a minute. It sounds like the wind. Calvert was not so sure. He turned his head back and forth, trying to locate the direction of the faint murmur that had come to them through the fog, but soon abandoned the attempt as hopeless. They continued the slide, reached the fourth level, and started on toward the fifth. All the while the sound grew louder and more hauntingly familiar. They were halfway down the fourth stairway when Myron called out, Now do you recognize it? They should have identified it long ago, but it was not a sound they would ever have associated with any world except Earth. Coming out of the fog, from a source whose distance could not be guessed, was the steady thunder of falling water. A few minutes later, the cloud ceiling ended as abruptly as it had begun. They shot out into the blinding glare of the Raman day, made more brilliant by the light reflected from the low-hanging clouds. There was the familiar curving plain, now made more acceptable to mind and senses because its full circle could no longer be seen. It was not too difficult to pretend that they were looking along a broad valley, and that the upward sweep of the sea was really an outward one. They halted at the fifth and penultimate platform to report that they were through the cloud cover and to make a careful survey. As far as they could tell, nothing had changed down there on the plain, but up here on the northern dome, Rama had brought forth another wonder. So there was the origin of the sound they had heard. Descending from some hidden source in the clouds, 3 or 4 kilometers away, was a waterfall. And for long minutes they stared at it silently, almost unable to believe their eyes. Logic told them that on this spinning world, no falling object could move in a straight line. But there was something horribly unnatural about a curving waterfall that curved sideways, to end many kilometers away from the point directly below its source.
"If Galileo had been born in this world," said Mercer finally, "he'd have gone crazy working out the laws of dynamics."
"I thought I knew them," Calvert replied, "and I'm going crazy anyway. Doesn't it upset you, Prof?"
"Why should it?" said Myron. "It's a perfectly straightforward demonstration of the Coriolis effect. I wish I could show it to some of my students."
Mercer was staring thoughtfully at the globe-circling band of the cylindrical sea.
"Have you noticed what's happened to the water?" he said at last.
"Why, it's no longer so blue. I'd call it pea green. What does that signify?"
"Perhaps the same thing that it does on Earth. Laura called the sea an organic soup, waiting to be shaken into life. Maybe that's exactly what's happened."
"In a couple of days? It took millions of years on Earth."
375 million, according to the latest estimate.
"So that's where the oxygen's come from. Rama's shot through the anaerobic stage and has got to photosynthetic plants in about 48 hours. I wonder what it will produce tomorrow."
22. To sail the cylindrical sea. When they reached the foot of the stairway, they had another shock. At first it appeared that something had gone through the camp, overturning equipment, even collecting smaller objects and carrying them away. But after a brief examination, their alarm was replaced by a rather shame-faced annoyance. The culprit was only the wind. Though they had tied down all loose objects before they left, some ropes must have parted during exceptionally strong gusts. It was several days before they were able to retrieve all their scattered property. Otherwise, there seemed no major changes. Even the silence of Rama had returned, now that the ephemeral storms of spring were over. And out there at the edge of the plain was a calm sea, waiting for the first ship in a million years.
"Shouldn't one christen a new boat with a bottle of champagne?"
"Even if we had some on board, I wouldn't allow such a criminal waste. Anyway, it's too late. We've already launched the thing." "At least it does float. You've won your bet, Jimmy. I'll settle when we get back to Earth."
"It's got to have a name. Any ideas?"
The subject of these unflattering comments was now bobbing beside the steps leading down into the cylindrical sea. It was a small raft, constructed from 6 empty storage drums, held together by a light metal framework. Building it, assembling it at Camp Alpha, and hauling it on demountable wheels across more than 10 kilometers of plain had absorbed the crew's entire energies for several days. It was a gamble that had better pay off. The prize was worth the risk. The enigmatic towers of New York, gleaming there in the shadowless light 5 kilometers away, had taunted them ever since they had entered Rama.
No one doubted that the city, or whatever it might be, was the real heart of this world. If they did nothing else, they must reach New York.
We still don't have a name. Skipper, what about it?
Norton laughed, then became suddenly serious.
I've got one for you. Call it Resolution.
Why?
That was one of Cook's ships. It's a good name. May she live up to it.
There was a thoughtful silence. Then Sergeant Barnes, who had been principally responsible for the design, asked for three volunteers. Everyone present held up a hand.
Sorry, we have only four life jackets. Boris, Jimmy, Peter. You've all done some sailing. Let's try her out.
No one thought it in the least peculiar that an executive sergeant was now taking charge of the proceedings. Ruby Barnes had the only master's certificate aboard, so that settled the matter. She had navigated racing trimarans across the Pacific, and it did not seem likely that a few kilometers of dead calm water would present much of a challenge to her skills. Ever since she had set eyes upon the sea, she had been determined to make this voyage. In all the thousands of years that man had had dealings with the waters of his own world, no sailor had ever faced anything remotely like this. In the last few days, a silly little jingle had been running through her mind, and she could not get rid of it. To sail the cylindrical sea? Well, that was precisely what she was going to do. Her passengers took their places on the improvised bucket seats, and Ruby opened the throttle. The 20-kilowatt motor started to whir, the chain drives of the reduction gear blurred, and Resolution surged away to the cheers of the spectators. Ruby had hoped to get 15 kph with this load, but would settle for anything over 10. A half-kilometer course had been measured along the cliff, and she made the round trip in 5.5 minutes. Allowing for turning time, this worked out at 12 kph, and she was quite happy with that. With no power, but with three energetic paddlers helping her own more skillful blade, Ruby was able to get a quarter of this speed. So even if the motor broke down, they could get back to shore in a couple of hours. The heavy-duty power cells could provide enough energy to circumnavigate the world, but she was carrying two spares, to be on the safe side. And now that the fog had completely burned away, even such a cautious mariner as Ruby was prepared to put to sea without a compass. She saluted smartly as she stepped ashore.
Maiden voyage of Resolution successfully completed, sir. Now awaiting your instructions.
Very good, Admiral. When will you be ready to sail?
As soon as stores can be loaded aboard and the harbormaster gives us clearance.
Then we leave at dawn.
Aye, aye, sir.
5 kilometers of water does not seem much on a map. It is very different when one is in the middle of it. They had been cruising for only 10 minutes, and the 50-meter cliff facing the northern continent already seemed a surprising distance away. Yet, mysteriously, New York appeared hardly much closer than before. Most of the time they paid little attention to the land. They were still too engrossed in the wonder of the sea. They no longer made the nervous jokes that had punctuated the start of the voyage. This new experience was too overwhelming.
Every time, Norton said to himself, I feel that I've grown accustomed to Rama. It produces some new wonder.
As Resolution hummed steadily forward, it seemed again and again that they were caught in the trough of a gigantic wave, a wave that curved up on either side until it became vertical, then overhung until the two flanks met in a liquid arch 16 kilometers above their heads. Despite everything that reason and logic told them, none of the voyagers could for long throw off the impression that at any minute those millions of tons of water would come crashing down from the sky. Yet, despite this, their main feeling was one of exhilaration. There was a sense of danger, without any real danger. Unless, of course, the sea itself produced more surprises. That was a distinct possibility, for, as Mercer had guessed, the water was now alive. Every spoonful contained thousands of spherical, single-celled microorganisms, similar to the earliest forms of plankton that had existed in the oceans of Earth. Yet they showed puzzling differences. They lacked a nucleus, as well as many of the other minimum requirements of even the most primitive terrestrial life forms. And although Laura Ernst, now doubling as research scientist and ship's doctor, had proved that they definitely generated oxygen, there were far too few of them to account for the augmentation of Rama's atmosphere. They should have existed in billions, not mere thousands. Then she discovered that their numbers were dwindling rapidly and must have been far higher during the first hours of the Raman dawn. It was as if there had been a brief explosion of life, recapitulating on a trillion-fold swifter timescale the early history of Earth. Now, perhaps, it had exhausted itself. The drifting microorganisms were disintegrating, releasing their stores of chemicals back into the sea. "If you have to swim for it," Dr. Ernst had warned the mariners, "keep your mouths closed. A few drops won't matter if you spit them out right away. But all those weird organometallic salts add up to a fairly poisonous package, and I'd hate to have to work out an antidote." This danger, fortunately, seemed unlikely. Resolution could stay afloat if any two of her buoyancy tanks were punctured. When told of this, Calvert had muttered darkly, "Remember the Titanic." And even if she sank, the crude but efficient life jackets would keep their heads above water. Although Dr. Ernst had been reluctant to give a firm ruling on this, she did not think that a few hours' immersion in the sea would be fatal. But she did not recommend it. After 20 minutes of steady progress, New York was no longer a distant island. It was becoming a real place, and details they had seen only through telescopes and photo enlargements were now revealing themselves as massive, solid structures. It was now strikingly apparent that the city, like so much of Rama, was triplicated. It consisted of three identical circular complexes or superstructures rising from a long, oval foundation. Photographs taken from the hub had also indicated that each complex was itself divided into three equal components, like a pie sliced into 120-degree portions. This would greatly simplify the task of exploration. Presumably they had to examine only 1/9 of New York to see the whole of it. Even this would be a formidable undertaking. It would mean investigating at least a square kilometer of buildings and machinery, some of which towered hundreds of meters into the air. The Ramans, it seemed, had brought the art of triple redundancy to a high degree of perfection. This was demonstrated in the airlock system, the stairways at the hub, the artificial suns. And where it really mattered, they had even taken the next step. New York appeared to be an example of triple-triple redundancy. Ruby was steering Resolution toward the central complex, where a flight of steps led up from the water to the top of the wall, or levee, that surrounded the island. There was even a conveniently placed mooring post to which boats could be tied. When she saw this, Ruby became quite excited. Now, she would never be content until she found one of the craft in which the Ramans sailed their extraordinary sea. Norton was the first to step ashore. He looked back at his three companions and said, "Wait here on the boat until I get to the top of the wall. When I wave, Peter and Boris will join me. You stay at the helm, Ruby, so that we can cast off at a moment's notice. If anything happens to me, report to Carl and follow his instructions. Use your best judgment, but no heroics. Understood?"
"Yes, Skipper. Good luck."
Commander Norton did not really believe in luck. He never got into a situation until he had analyzed all the factors involved and had secured his line of retreat. But once again, Rama was forcing him to break some of his cherished rules. Almost every factor here was unknown as the Pacific and the Great Barrier Reef had been to his hero 3.5 centuries ago. Yes, he could do with all the luck that happened to be lying around. The stairway was a virtual duplicate of the one they had descended on the other side of the sea, where, doubtless, his friends were looking straight across at him through their telescopes. And straight was now the correct word. In this one direction, parallel to the axis of Rama, the sea was indeed completely flat. It might well be the only body of water in the universe of which this was true, for on all other worlds, every sea and lake must follow the surface of a sphere, with equal curvature in all directions.
"Nearly at the top," he reported, speaking for the record and for his intently listening second-in-command, 5 kilometers away. "Still completely quiet. Radiation normal. I'm holding the meter above my head, just in case this wall is acting as a shield for anything. And if there are any hostiles on the other side, they'll shoot that first."
He was joking, of course. And yet, why take any chances, when it was just as easy to avoid them? When he took the last step, he found that the flat-topped embankment was about 10 meters thick. On the inner side, an alternating series of ramps and stairways led down to the main level of the city, 20 meters below. In effect, he was standing on a high wall, which completely surrounded New York, and so was able to get a grandstand view of it. It was a view almost stunning in its complexity, and his first act was to make a slow panoramic scan with his camera. Then he waved to his companions and radioed back across the sea. "No sign of any activity. Everything quiet. Come on up. We'll start exploring." 23. N.Y. Rama. It was not a city. It was a machine. Norton had come to that conclusion in 10 minutes, and saw no reason to change it after they had made a complete traverse of the island. A city, whatever the nature of its occupants, surely had to provide some form of accommodation. There was nothing here of that nature, unless it was underground. And if that was the case, where were the entrances, the stairways, the elevators? He had not found anything that even qualified as a simple door. The closest analogy to this place that he had ever seen on Earth was a giant chemical processing plant. However, there were no stockpiles of raw materials or any indications of a transport system to move them around. Nor could he imagine where the finished product would emerge, still less what that product could possibly be. It was all very baffling, and more than a little frustrating. "Anybody care to make a guess?" he said at last, to all who might be listening. "If this is a factory, what does it make, and where does it get its raw materials?"
"I've a suggestion, Skipper," said Mercer, over on the far shore. "Suppose it uses the sea. According to Doc, that contains just about anything you can think of."
It was a plausible answer, and Norton had already considered it. there could well be buried pipes leading to the sea. In fact, there must be, for any conceivable chemical plant would require large quantities of water. But he had a suspicion of plausible answers. They were so often wrong.
That's a good idea, Kyle. But what does New York do with its seawater?
For a long time, nobody answered from ship, hub, or northern plain. Then an unexpected voice spoke.
That's easy, Skipper, but you're all going to laugh at me.
No, we're not, Ravi. Go ahead. Ravi McAndrews, chief steward and simp master, was the last person on the Endeavor who would normally get involved in a technical discussion. His IQ was modest, and his scientific knowledge was minimal, but he was no fool, and he had a natural shrewdness that everyone respected.
Well, it's a factory, all right, Skipper, and maybe the sea provides the raw material. After all, that's how it all happened on Earth, though in a different way. I believe New York is a factory for making ramens.
Somebody, somewhere, snickered, but became quickly silent and did not identify himself.
You know, Ravi, said his commander at last, that theory is crazy enough to be true, and I'm not sure if I want to see it tested, at least until I get back to the mainland.
This celestial New York was just about as wide as the island of Manhattan, but its geometry was totally different. There were few straight thoroughfares. It was a maze of short, concentric arcs, with radial spokes linking them. Luckily, it was impossible to lose one's bearings inside Rama. A single glance at the sky was enough to establish the north-south axis of the world. They paused at almost every intersection to make a panoramic scan. When all these hundreds of pictures were sorted out, it would be a tedious but fairly straightforward job to construct an accurate scale model of the city. Norton suspected that the resulting jigsaw puzzle would keep scientists busy for generations. It was even harder to get used to the silence here than it had been out on the plain of Rama. A city machine should make some sound. Yet there was not even the faintest of electric hums, or the slightest whisper of mechanical motion. Several times Norton put his ear to the ground, or to the side of a building, and listened intently. He could hear nothing except the pounding of his own blood. The machines were sleeping. They were not even ticking over. Would they ever wake again? And for what purpose? Everything was in perfect condition, as usual. It was easy to believe that the closing of a single circuit in some patient, hidden computer would bring all this maze back to life. When at last they had reached the far side of the city, they climbed to the top of the surrounding levee and looked across the southern branch of the sea. For a long time, Norton stared at the 500-meter cliff that barred them from almost half of Rama, and, judging from their telescopic surveys, the most complex and varied half. From this angle, it appeared an ominous, forbidding black, and it was easy to think of it as a prison wall surrounding a whole continent. Nowhere along its entire circle were there stairways, or any other means of access. He wondered how the Ramans reached their southern land from New York. Probably there was a transport system running beneath the sea, but they must also have aircraft, because there were many open areas here in the city that could be used for landing. To discover a Raman vehicle would be a major accomplishment, especially if they could learn to operate it. Though could any conceivable power source still be functioning after several hundred thousand years? There were numerous structures that had the functional look of hangars or garages, but they were all smooth and windowless,
as if they had been sprayed with sealer.
Sooner or later, Norton told himself grimly. We'll be forced to use explosives and laser beams.
He was determined to put off this decision to the last possible moment. His reluctance to use brute force was based partly on pride, partly on fear. He did not wish to behave like a technological barbarian, smashing what he could not understand. After all, he was an uninvited visitor in this world, and should act accordingly. As for his fear, perhaps that was too strong a word. Apprehension might be better. The Ramans seemed to have planned for everything. He was not anxious to discover the precautions they had taken to guard their property. When he sailed back to the mainland, it would be with empty hands.
24. Dragonfly. Lieutenant James Pack was the most junior officer on board Endeavor, and this was only his fourth mission into deep space. He was ambitious and due for promotion. He had also committed a serious breach of regulations. No wonder, therefore, that he took a long time to make up his mind. It would be a gamble. If he lost, he could be in deep trouble. He would not only be risking his career, he might even be risking his neck. But if he succeeded, he would be a hero. What finally convinced him was neither of these arguments. It was the certainty that if he did nothing at all, he would spend the rest of his life brooding over his lost opportunity. Nevertheless, he was still hesitant when he asked Commander Norton for a private meeting.
What is it this time? Norton asked himself as he analyzed the uncertain expression on the young officer's face. He remembered his delicate interview with Boris Rodrigo. No, it wouldn't be anything like that. Pack was certainly not the religious type. The only interests he had ever shown outside his work were sport and sex, preferably combined. It could hardly be the former, and Norton hoped it was not the latter. He had encountered most of the problems that a commanding officer could encounter in this department, except the classical one of an unscheduled birth during a mission. Though this situation was the subject of innumerable jokes, it had never happened yet. But such gross incompetence was probably only a matter of time.
Well, Jimmy, what is it?
I have an idea, Commander. I know how to reach the southern continent, even the South Pole.
I'm listening.
How do you propose to do it?
By flying there.
Jimmy, I've had at least 5 proposals to do that. More, if you count crazy suggestions from Earth. We've looked into the possibility of adapting our spacesuit propulsors, but air drag would make them hopelessly inefficient. They'd run out of fuel before they could go 10 kilometers.
I know that, but I have the answer.
Peck's attitude was a curious mixture of complete confidence and barely suppressed nervousness. Norton was quite baffled. What was the kid worried about? Surely he knew his commanding officer well enough to be certain that no reasonable proposal would be laughed out of court.
Well, go on. If it works, I'll see your promotion is retroactive.
That little half-promise, half-joke didn't go down as well as he had hoped. Jimmy gave a rather sickly smile, made several false starts, then decided on an oblique approach to the subject.
You know, Commander, that I was in the Lunar Olympics last year.
Of course. Sorry you didn't win.
It was bad equipment. I know what went wrong. I have friends on Mars who've been working on it, in secret. We want to give everyone a surprise.
Mars? But I didn't know.
Not many people do.
The sport's still new there. It's only been tried in the Zante Sports Dome. But the best aerodynamicists in the solar system are on Mars. If you can fly in that atmosphere, you can fly anywhere. Now, my idea was that if the Martians could build a good machine with all their know-how, it would really perform on the moon, where gravity is only half as strong.
That seems plausible, but how does it help us?
Norton was beginning to guess, but he wanted to give Jimmy plenty of rope. Well, I formed a syndicate with some friends in Port Lowell. They've built a fully aerobatic flyer with some refinements that no one has ever seen before. In lunar gravity, under the Olympic Dome, it should create a sensation.
And win you the gold medal.
I hope so.
Let me see if I follow your train of thought correctly. A sky bike that could enter the Lunar Olympics at a sixth of a gravity would be even more sensational inside Rama, with no gravity at all. You could fly it right along the axis, from the North Pole to the South and back again.
Yes, easily. The one-way trip would take 3 hours non-stop. But, of course, you could rest whenever you wanted to, as long as you kept near the axis.
It's a brilliant idea, and I congratulate you. What a pity skybikes aren't part of regular space survey equipment.
Jimmy seemed to have some difficulty in finding words. He opened his mouth several times, but nothing happened.
All right, Jimmy. As a matter of morbid interest and purely off the record, how did you smuggle the thing aboard?
Recreational stores?
Well, you weren't lying. And what about the weight?
It's only 20 kilograms.
Only?
Still, it's not as bad as I thought. In fact, I'm astonished you can build a bike at that weight. Some have been only 15, but they were too fragile and usually folded up when they made a turn. There's no danger of Dragonfly doing that. As I said, she's fully aerobatic.
Dragonfly. Nice name.
So tell me just how you plan to use her. Then I can decide whether a promotion or a court-martial is in order. Or both.
25. Maiden Flight.
Dragonfly was certainly a good name. The long, tapering wings were almost invisible, except when the light struck them from certain angles and was refracted into rainbow hues. It was as if a soap bubble had been wrapped around a delicate tracery of aerofoil sections. The envelope enclosing the little flyer was an organic film, only a few molecules thick, yet strong enough to control and direct the movements of a 50-kilometer-per-hour airflow. The pilot, who was also the power plant and the guidance system, sat on a tiny seat at the center of gravity, in a semi-reclining position to reduce air resistance. Control was by a single stick, which could be moved backward and forward, right and left. The only instrument was a piece of weighted ribbon attached to the leading edge to show the direction of the relative wind. Once the flyer had been assembled at the hub, Jimmy Pack would allow no one to touch it. Clumsy handling could snap one of the single-fiber structural members, and those glittering wings were an almost irresistible attraction to prying fingers. It was hard to believe that there was really something there. As he watched Jimmy climb into the contraption, Norton began to have second thoughts. If one of those wire-sized struts snapped when Dragonfly was on the other side of the cylindrical sea, Jimmy would have no way of getting back, even if he was able to make a safe landing. They were also breaking one of the most sacrosanct rules of space exploration. A man was going alone into unknown territory, beyond all possibility of help. The only consolation was that he would be in full view and communication all the time. If he did meet with disaster, they would know exactly what had happened to him.
yet this opportunity was far too good to miss. If one believed in fate or destiny, it would be challenging the gods themselves to neglect the only chance they might ever have of reaching the far side of Rama and seeing at close quarters the mysteries of the South Pole. Jimmy knew what he was attempting, far better than anyone in the crew could tell him. This was precisely the sort of risk that had to be taken. If it failed, that was the luck of the game. You couldn't win them all.
"Now listen to me carefully, Jimmy," said Laura Ernst. "It's very important not to overexert yourself. Remember, the oxygen level here at the Axis is still very low. If you feel breathless at any time, stop and hyperventilate for 30 seconds, but no longer."
Jimmy nodded absentmindedly as he tested the controls. The whole rudder elevator assembly, which formed a single unit on an outrigger 5 meters behind the rudimentary cockpit, began to twist around. Then the flap-shaped ailerons, halfway along the wing, moved alternately up and down.
"Do you want me to swing the prop?" asked Joe Calvert, unable to repress memories of 200-year-old war movies.
"Ignition. Contact." Probably no one except Jimmy knew what he was talking about, but it helped to relieve the tension. Very slowly, Jimmy started to move the foot pedals. The flimsy, broad fan of the air screw, like the wing, a delicate skeleton covered with shimmering film, began to turn. By the time it had made a few revolutions, it had disappeared completely, and Dragonfly was on her way. She lifted straight upward, or outward, from the hub, moving slowly along the axis of Rama. When she had traveled 100 meters, Jimmy stopped pedaling. It was strange to see an obviously aerodynamic vehicle hanging motionless in mid-air. This must be the first time such a thing had ever happened, except possibly on a limited scale inside one of the larger space stations.
"How does she handle?" Norton called.
"Response good, stability poor. But I know what the trouble is, no gravity. We'll be better off a kilometer lower down."
"Now, wait a minute. Is that safe?"
By losing altitude, Jimmy would be sacrificing his main advantage. As long as he stayed precisely on the axis, he and Dragonfly would be completely weightless. He could hover effortlessly, or even go to sleep if he wished. But as soon as he moved away from the central line around which Rama spun, the pseudo-weight of centrifugal force would reappear. And so, unless he could maintain himself at this altitude, he would continue to lose height, and at the same time, to gain weight. It would be an accelerating process, which could end in catastrophe. The gravity down on the plane of Rama was twice that in which Dragonfly had been designed to operate. Jimmy might be able to make a safe landing. He could certainly never take off again. But he had already considered all this, and he answered confidently enough.
"I can manage a tenth of a G without any trouble, and she'll handle more easily in denser air."
In a slow, leisurely spiral, Dragonfly drifted across the sky, roughly following the line of Stairway Alpha down toward the plain. From some angles, the little skybike was almost invisible. Jimmy seemed to be sitting in mid-air, pedaling furiously. Sometimes he moved in spurts of up to 30 kilometers an hour, then he would coast to a halt, getting the feel of the controls, before accelerating again. And he was always careful to keep a safe distance from the curving face of Rama. It was soon obvious that Dragonfly handled much better at lower altitudes. She no longer rolled around at any angle, but stabilized so that her wings were parallel to the plane 7 kilometers below. Jimmy completed several wide orbits
then started to climb upward again. He finally halted a few meters above his waiting colleagues and realized, a little belatedly, that he was not quite sure how to land his gossamer craft.
"Shall we throw you a rope?" Norton asked, half seriously.
"No, Skipper. I've got to work this out myself. I won't have anyone to help me at the other end." He sat, thinking for a while, then started to ease Dragonfly toward the hub with short bursts of power. She quickly lost momentum between each, as air drag brought her to rest again. When he was only 5 meters away and the skybike was still barely moving, Jimmy abandoned ship. He let himself float toward the nearest safety line in the hub webwork, grasped it, then swung around in time to catch the approaching bike with his hands. The maneuver was so neatly executed that it drew a round of applause.
"For my next act," Joe Calvert began.
Jimmy was quick to disclaim any credit.
"That was messy," he said.
"But now I know how to do it. I'll take a sticky bomb on a 20-meter line. Then I'll be able to pull myself in wherever I want to."
"Give me your wrist, Jimmy," ordered the doctor. "And blow into this bag. I'll want a blood sample, too. Did you have any difficulty in breathing?"
"Only at this altitude."
"Hey, what do you want the blood for?"
"Sugar level, so I can tell how much energy you've used. We've got to make sure you can carry enough fuel for the mission. By the way, what's the endurance record for skybiking?"
2 hours, 25 minutes, 3.6 seconds. On the moon, of course. A 2-kilometer circuit in the Olympic Dome."
"And you think you can keep it up for 6 hours?
"Easily, since I can stop for a rest at any time. Skybiking on the moon is at least twice as hard as it is here."
"Okay, Jimmy, back to the lab. I'll give you a go, no go, as soon as I've analyzed these samples. I don't want to raise false hopes, but I think you can make it."
A large smile of satisfaction spread across Jimmy's ivory-hued countenance. As he followed Surgeon Commander Ernst to the airlock, he called back to his companions.
"Hands off, please! I don't want anyone putting his fist through the wings."
"I'll see to that, Jimmy," promised the commander. "Dragonfly is off limits to everybody, including myself."
26. The Voice of Rama. The real magnitude of his adventure did not hit Jimmy Pack until he reached the coast of the Cylindrical Sea. Until now, he had been over known territory. Barring a catastrophic structural failure, he could always land and walk back to base in a few hours. That option no longer existed. If he came down in the sea, he would probably drown, quite unpleasantly, in its poisonous waters. And even if he made a safe landing on the southern continent, it might be impossible to rescue him before Endeavor had to break away from Rama's sunward orbit. He was also acutely aware that the foreseeable disasters were the ones most unlikely to happen. The totally unknown region over which he was flying might produce any number of surprises. Suppose there were flying creatures here who objected to his intrusion. He would hate to engage in a dogfight with anything larger than a pigeon. A few well-placed pecks could destroy Dragonfly's aerodynamics. Yet, if there were no hazards, there would be no achievement, no sense of adventure. Millions of men would gladly have traded places with him now. He was going not only where no one had ever been before, but also where no one would ever go again. In all of history, he would be the only human being to visit the southern regions of Rama. Whenever he felt fear brushing against his mind, he could remember that.
He had now grown accustomed to sitting in mid-air with the world wrapped around him. Because he had dropped 2 kilometers below the central axis, he had acquired a definite sense of up and down.